Welcome to The Film Show on KBOO. I'm SW Conser, and today we're bringing you a preview of the 45th Annual Portland Filmmakers Festival. Our good friend Ben Pop is in the studio. Hello, Ben.
Hello, Conch. How are you?
Good, good. Ben is the programmer for the Northwest Film Center, and he's joined by two local filmmakers, Paula Bernstein and Edward Peck Davey. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, the festival is going to be running from Halloween through
November 5th.
Monday. November 5th, which is Guy Fawkes Day, right?
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, I know that in the middle we had daylight savings.
Right. Oh, yeah. So that's going to mess with your schedule a little bit. Well, listeners can find a full calendar of screenings and events at nwfilm.org, where you'll have to watch out for the time change. But, we're going to be asking Edward and Paula about their films, which are going to be playing at the festival. But first, what I want to do is I want to hop into the Wayback Machine and play a conversation with Quinn Costello. Quinn is a documentarian. His new film is Rodents of Unusual Size. He was in town for a screening of that, and the documentary will be airing on PBS on their show Independent Lens in January. So let's hear Quinn talk about that film. I'm here in the studio with Quinn Costello. He's the co-director, along with Chris Metzler, of Rodents of Unusual Size. This is a documentary shot down in Louisiana. Well, Quinn, tell us about the film.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks so much for having me on the show. It was a film that took about 4 years to make, all told. It was shot in the swamps of Louisiana, and it follows the nutria, which is like this 20-pound invasive rodent that is running roughshod all over the state and a huge scourge. And
originally from South America, is that right?
From Argentina, that's right. And they are a big problem because they eat all the plants that kind of guard against hurricanes and help reinforce the land. And so as Louisiana disappears and it's losing about a football field of land every hour, these giant rodents are a huge part of that problem.
We actually have nutria here in Oregon, and a lot of times when people see a beaver, or what they think is a beaver, out in, say, Beaverton, it's actually a nutria. It doesn't have the paddle tail. It's got the orange rat tail and the orange teeth.
There's that weird moment of kind of horror and realization when people think that they're just going to see a beaver, which are pretty cute, right? And then they realize, like, oh my God, that's not a beaver. It's got a long rat tail and these bright orange teeth, and it kind of is it goes from being totally endearing to totally to just a feeling of utter revulsion usually. So, you know, there are a lot of different perspectives on whether or not they're cute, you know, but depending on the context, if you see them swimming around in the swamp, they look like pretty monstrous.
Well, the nutria have become the mascot of a number of organizations down in Louisiana, including a AAA ball team.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because they are this environmental scourge, you know, and they're destroying Louisiana in a lot of ways. And they're a huge problem. But because they are such outsiders, literally, and they've kind of continued to thrive, and they just are a part of the reality of what it's like down there. They've also been adopted into the culture in all these strange ways, and you get people who hunt nutria who also raise them as pets, you know, and big murals of nutria all over the city, and people are cooking nutria and wearing nutria, and so it's like everywhere you turn down there, there's some kind of reference to nutria. It's like this kind of begrudging admiration, I think, is the attitude that folks have.
Well, the title character in the film, Rodents of Unusual Size, is the nutria, but the film is really following all of these people, these natives of South Louisiana, and fans of HBO's show Tremé will recognize Kermit Ruffins, the jazz trumpeter who makes a point of roasting nutria outside his concerts.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Kermit is a legendary fixture in New Orleans and an amazing jazz trumpet player. But his real passion is cooking, you know. And we went to one of his shows and we were talking with him afterwards. And he asked us why we were in town, and we told him we were making a movie about Nutria. And he was like, oh, my God, I love Nutria. I'll barbecue one for you in front of my bar in a couple of days, you know. And we, you know, jumped at the opportunity. And, you know, Kermit Ruffins kind of has this everything and approach towards cooking, where it's just tons of Italian seasoning and all kinds of garlic and a beet of beer and all these things to kind of ramp up the flavor of it. But if you have the love for the cooking and barbecuing process, you know, you can make Nutria taste pretty good. I mean, and it's fun to watch people who are drifting by outside look and see, like, oh my God, is Kermit cooking a rat, you know? And they're like, I'll never try it, I'll never try it. But after kind of watching him for a while and, you know, seeing it come together and the smells start wafting up, people start to change their minds. And it is delicious.
It is delicious. What would you compare it to?
Rabbit.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. So kind of lean, you have to...
Yeah, it's lean, and it's a vegetarian animal, you know? So it's very lean. It's not very fatty meat. And that was one of the reasons why the state implemented this program when they were first starting to reckon with the problem of the nutria of, we're just going to get people to eat them out of existence. So they invested all this money in a PR campaign, you know, where they were getting famous chefs like Paul Prudhomme and all these different people to extol the virtues of Nutria and try to just get people excited about eating it themselves. And the campaign fell flat on its face because of the stigma, because they look like these giant rats. People were not interested in eating them. So then the state settled on a new idea, which was to basically just pay people to hunt Nutria. And the way that you prove that you killed a Nutria is you turn in a tail for $5 at a Nutria tail collection site.
Right. And some of the other people that you follow in the film are the hunters and trappers, the Cajuns, the people who have been down in Louisiana for centuries in the bayous. Yeah, some interesting characters.
Thanks. Yeah, we met. I mean, Louisiana is this incredible place where you basically just get out of your car and there's this kind of goodwill assumption that, you know, because you're curious, we are happy to tell our story. There's there were 30 reality shows being filmed while we were down there. So,
really?
So there's a lot of trepidation. They don't like to be caricatured, of course, and they don't like the way that they're portrayed in these reality shows. But
I tend to argue with the term reality TV. I generally call it badly scripted TV.
Yeah, it's so boring in a lot of ways, too. It's like these heightened situations, but because it's so stiff, wooden, and staged, it's so boring to watch. It doesn't feel like anything is really happening.
Also, my mom's family's from Louisiana, northern Louisiana.
Yeah, yeah.
And you look at, say, the Duck Dynasty people, and you realize these are country club people who grew out their beards for TV.
That's right. Where the real people are there, and they have an incredible warmth and generosity. And I actually asked a Cajun friend, coming in there as an outsider, if he had any tips for, you know, talking to Cajun people respectfully and everything. And he's like, oh, don't worry, you're not going to be talking, which was kind of true. I mean, we get out of...
They're great storytellers.
They're incredible storytellers.
And one fellow in particular that you...
Yeah, Thomas Gonzalez was really special because he really is living as far down the bayou as you possibly can, in the place that's has no protection from the levees and is completely exposed to hurricanes. He's lost his house 3 times to hurricanes, and yet something keeps drawing him back to that spot. You know, while everybody else has left, there's something about that particular spot that he is connected to, and, you know, and has been through his family for hundreds of years. And so it was really interesting to us to kind of capture Louisiana at this moment in time as it's really changing into something very different. I mean, I don't know that Thomas's island is going to be there in 15 years, you know, at the rate of the coastal erosion that's happening. So we really wanted to show this really special, incredible place where people are meeting these challenges, not with despair, but with joy. And they're literally every day living in this kind of, with this ecstatic kind of attitude. And yet it really is disappearing and going underwater.
How did you get introduced to these people? Are either you or Chris Metzler natives of the region?
No, and we made the film also with a third guy named Jeff Springer, and none of us are native to Louisiana. I grew up in Idaho, and I live in the Bay Area, and Chris and Jeff lived in the Bay Area when we first got started. And Chris and I are both from rural areas. He's from Missouri. And so growing up in Idaho, I was around a lot of hunting, but it was a very different culture in the sense of Idaho is a lot more partitioned. People certainly are not in each other's lives in nearly the same way that they are in Louisiana.
You're mentioning the islands. I know that there are, say, native people that are being moved off the islands in the Gulf that are starting to get swamped by rising sea levels and hurricanes. So tell us a little bit about the role of the nutria there.
Mm-hmm. Well, as the land kind of disappears in southern Louisiana and these barrier islands kind of recede into the ocean, any attempts to replant native plants and to try to bring the land back are completely negated if the nutria are there, because at those critical early stages when you're planting these young plants, the nutria will just come eat them. And they eat half their body weight almost every day. So they're 20-pound rats, basically. 20-pound rodents eating 10 pounds of vegetation. And then they're having dozens of babies every year. So there is no way that you can bring back land or try to mitigate the damage at all if the nutria are there. So that's why it's so important to get them under control. And the area that you were just referencing where we spend a little time with some of the Native American tribe, the Houma tribe down there, they are really committed to using the whole nutria. I mean, the tail collection program, obviously, you chop off the tail and you leave the animal in the swamp, you know, and that's not a particularly good thing, you know, especially if you are an animal lover and you care about the ecology of the area. So the Native American folks that we were with were a lot more committed to, like, for one thing, we're going to eat the meat. We're going to sell the fur, even though there isn't much of a market for nutria fur anymore. There are some people who are trying to change that and bring nutria fur back and remarket it this time towards, this is eco-friendly fur. And one of their biggest markets is like hipsters who are wearing it ironically, but also ironically, they're saving the wetlands by doing that. And so they kind of exist in this different approach to the nutria where it's going to be, you know, it's a shame that they're here, but while they are here, we're going to use every part of them in order to help solve this problem.
There's some pretty amazing cinematography that's featured in your film.
Thanks. Yeah, that's all Jeff Springer. He shot the whole thing. When we started out, it was a 5D camera that we were using, which is a little DSLR, little camera. And it's the funny thing with documentaries is they take so long that by the time you finish, technology has totally moved on from where you started. But he did some really cool things with that camera and using a lot of time lapses. It was really important to us to kind of take you through a cycle of the seasons down there. So you kind of connect a little bit more to the natural environment and the world that you're in with these nutria hunters and crabbers and shrimpers and everybody who really are dependent on what's going on in the weather and the cycle of the seasons for their livelihood. So we wanted to embrace that naturalistic kind of approach, and he got some really beautiful shots of the swamps.
Now you're touring the film around. Have you taken it down to the Deep South, to the Gulf States, and shown it to the people that have been part of the film?
So, we were just in Louisiana in August with the Louisiana premiere. And our main subject, so we had a few people there. We had and animals. So we had a stunt nutria there named Nudie, who is featured in the film. So she came out and walked the red carpet. We had a fashion show of a bunch of people wearing the nutria fashion and coming and showing that off. And then we, of course, had our main subject, Thomas Gonzalez, who drove up from Delacroix Island. He hadn't been to New Orleans, even though it's an hour away. He hadn't been there in probably 20 or 30 years. And he watched the movie and he was very, I think, impacted by seeing his life, you know, on the screen. And then when it was over, he got on stage for the Q&A. There was one question that he answered for 20 minutes.
A great storyteller again.
Exactly. And then that was the end of the Q&A. And then he sat down and watched the whole film again because there was a second screening. And he got up during the credits and started dancing. He's a huge dancer. And then he left and went crabbing later that night. And that was it. And it was really wonderful. You know, we went and spent some more time with him and all of the other characters afterwards. And I think there's an appreciation that there is this moment in time that's being captured in their lives, because they know that even though things have kind of been the same and that this hunting and trapping tradition and the Cajun tradition down there has been the same way for a very long time, that they realize that it's changing and that a lot of them are going to have to move and relocate. So I think that they appreciate that there is now this kind of capsule that captures what life was like there over the last 5 years.
Louisiana is not a big place for many Hollywood films, aside from, say, The Big Easy, or, you know, which is 30 years ago. Louisiana is very popular with independent filmmakers from Europe and Canada. And have you gotten the bug now? Do you want to go down? Do you want to hear more stories from the people down there?
I was kind of... When we were down there on this last trip, and it was the first time I had been there over, you know, 4 or 5 years without needing to film, without kind of having a reason to be there except to just spend time with the folks and to show the film. By the end, I was just like asking everybody I could meet, like, what is another story? You know, where, what can we do next? Because there's something about that place that just gets into your bloodstream, and it's something about the food. It's really about the kind of joy that people have down there and this kind of way of life where you just kind of take the time to hang out and connect. Everybody wants to kind of connect with each other, you know, and there's just kind of this free-flowing kind of breeziness to the people that you know, you just walk down the street and you can end up in it talking for an hour to someone who's just hanging out on their porch stoop, you know, and of course the music and everything. So I'm really looking for another project down there. We shot with a number of different folks that ended up not really fitting into the film as well. So we're making those into a few short films that we're going to kind of put out next year to kind of supplement the Rodents of Unusual Size, you know, once that's on TV and everything.
Yeah, the late, great filmmaker Les Blank made a series of amazing documentaries down there back in the late 20th century about the music, about the food, about the culture in general. Back when all of that was really vital, it just seems like some of that's starting to die off now.
It is, but it makes me smile whenever somebody invokes Les Blank, because he was a friend.
Is that right?
I ate some raccoon stew with him. That was the first time, you know, I ever met him. And he was just this fixture in the filmmaking scene in the Bay Area where I'm from. And his films that he did in Cajun country were huge inspirations, you know, in the sense of it was kind of what we were hoping to do with this film, and the approach of just, we're just going to go down there. We're just going to kind of hang out and spend time. And this film will really be a chronicle of what all of those relationships were like, tied together by the story of the Nutria, right? And there are some connections to Les Blank in the film. The family that he was following, the Cajun family, Mark and Anne Savoie, their daughter ended up being our photographer for the film. And so Gabrielle Savoie took all of our production stills, and you can see some of her work, which is just incredible. The whole family are all musicians. They play together with the parents. And there's some Mardi Gras scenes, and there's a very particularly creepy country Mardi Gras scene that's organized by their son, Joel, and that Mark Savoie was at. So I kind of felt this connection to Les Blank, you know, as we were making the film. He passed away a couple of years ago, but definitely was carrying his kind of spirit of curiosity and joy into this. And well, yes, I think that Louisiana is changing. The culture is still very much alive, and people are still speaking Cajun French and still extremely proud of their culture. It's just that the reality is the culture is connected to the place, you know, and the place is disappearing. And so as Louisiana continues to disappear and more people transition to working in the oil and natural gas industry as opposed to hunting, fishing, crabbing, and all these different things, it is changing. And so I really can't recommend enough to anyone who's curious about Louisiana to just go down there and just hang out, spend time, take the time to get to know the people and have some long conversations.
Any scenes, any stories that didn't make the cut that you wish you could have fit into the film?
Well, personally, that creepy kind of Mardi Gras scene that was in the country, when we went to film there, you know, you're supposed to come dressed up in costume, which I did. I went to great length to get, you know, traditional Mardi Gras costumes for myself and Chris and Jeff. But what I forgot to do was bring a mask, you know? And we got there and it was 6:30 in the morning and it was freezing cold. And they had these kind of, they look almost like warlocks. These guys who are dressed up, they're called the Valans. And they're kind of the security force of the Mardi Gras run. And the Mardi Gras run is you go from house to house and you dance and you beg for chickens. People throw chickens out and then you take the chicken and then you put that into the gumbo. Everyone eats the gumbo and sings and dances. And it's really interesting experience. And anyway, so we showed up completely tacky that we didn't have our masks. We didn't think we were going to get to go and film because we were in the middle of nowhere. That was a pretty discouraging notion. But they were like, get down in the mud and roll around in the mud and stick the mud on your face and that'll be your mask. And so we were in the mud, you know, and the mud's getting all over the gear and the cameras and everything. And then they, for anybody who it was their first time, everybody kind of had to lay on the ground while this villains walk and pour whiskey over you and whip you and stuff like that. And it's just this crazy hazing ritual. And I did not know if I was going to get out of there alive. But then they get up, they start playing music, they go from house to house. It was this amazing visual sequence. And then when it was all over, we were like cooking gumbo. And then the same people who were whipping me earlier were just like, hey, man, welcome to Louisiana. I hope you're having a great time. You know, it's really wonderful to see some new faces here. And, you know,
whipping you with hickory switches or
yeah,
switches.
Yeah, it was all out of love. And it wasn't like the kind of hazing that people are doing in college. It is just kind of about protecting this really unique ritual and making sure that there is some kind of barrier to entry, you know.
So the film's been getting some really amazing buzz.
Thanks,
And some award nominations and wins.
Yeah, we didn't quite know what was going to happen with the film. You know, when you kind of push a movie out there into the world, you just say, oh, here we go, and whatever happens, happens. But we've been really delighted, and it's been in 75 film festivals so far, and, you know, we've won a number of, you know, best documentary feature awards and different kinds of awards at the festivals. And I think what people are resonating with right now is it is an environmental film, but it's an environmental film that has some hope and some joy, and that culture of Louisiana allows you to kind of connect to this issue that we hope people care about. It's such a strange topic too. And we really try to take a non-judgmental approach that just shows this is a chronicle of what it was like to spend some time down there. And I think that, you know, Louisiana is just has this infectious kind of shine to it. You know, there's just something about it that makes people feel really, really good. So we're pleased with how it's been received out there. And we're looking forward to it really having a large audience on PBS. We're going to be on Independent Lens in January. So that'll be the end of the festival run.
So how can people find out more about your film, Rodents of Unusual Size?
Yeah, it's rodentsofunusualsize.tv is the website. You can follow us on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. And if you go to the website, you can see all of our upcoming screenings and And if you follow us on Facebook, we have updates of all things Nutria, you know, as well as kind of a chronicle of our adventures around the country with the film. And then also you might want to check out the Facebook page for Nudie the Nutria, who was our stunt Nutria in the film. She's a bit of a diva and she likes a large Facebook audience.
Well, Quinn Costello is the co-director of Rodents of Unusual Size, the documentary about the nutria of Louisiana. Quinn, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that was our interview with Quinn Costello, the director of Rodents of Unusual Size. Are you listening to The Film Show? I'm S.W. Konser. And we are in the studio now with Ben Popp. He's introing the Northwest Filmmakers Festival.
Yes.
And Ben, we're also here with Paula Bernstein and Edward Pack Davy, and we want to have a conversation about what's going to be happening at the Portland Filmmakers Festival. But first, I want to play a little clip from Paula's short documentary. It's called Soul Doctor, and it takes place in a cobbler shop here in Southeast Portland. Here's a little clip.
Fixing shoes is an art. Shoes that are made now are made to throw away when they wear down, but me and Josh had to learn to fix them, you see, so we could keep on making a living. And Josh, he's my apprentice. Now, I could leave town now, and he could run the shop. He could still have a shoe repair shop on Hawthorne.
It'll be Josh's shoe repair.
You know, until they run us out of here.
And Paula, that was no spoilers here, but there's a lot that develops during the short documentary that you made called Soul Doctor.
Yes, when I first started out making the film, I really just was interested in George. George is the proprietor of George's Shoe Repair Shop on Hawthorne, and I knew that he had run the business for over 50 years. And given that Portland is changing so quickly and I'm a relative newcomer, I was interested in hearing some of his past stories about Portland. And very soon I realized that there was what interested me more was his relationship with his son. But I had no idea that there would be, without a spoiler, but basically George is preparing to retire. And then Josh, his son, who was a modern dancer, is preparing to take over the shop.
So this is, I mean, what gets talked about in the documentary is that this is the area, this is the era of discardable materials, discardable clothing, fast fashion. So it's almost quaint to have a place that repairs shoes. There are more than one shoe repair places in Portland. So, but this guy is a master of the craft. And how did you sort of fall into doing this doc? You've been writing about film. You've been working in the business for years and years and years and years. But this is, I believe, your first documentary.
It is my first documentary ever. And I have been lucky enough, though, to learn from many of the great filmmakers I've been able to interview over the years. And I've been able to go to documentary film festivals and panels as a journalist. And then really going to Oregon Doc Camp, which I've done for the past few years, has really inspired me as well.
And Ben, so Paula's documentary is part of a particular event, a part of a series that's happening at the Northwest Filmmakers Festival, and it's definitely something that you're fostering, is having these new filmmakers come up from the region?
Yeah, so this is part of the one thing that we're doing this year is the Northwest Regional Survey. So we got together six different curators from around the region to put together short film programs from their respective state or province. So the idea being that rather than films through the selection process and there being particular things that fall through the cracks, we're really able to present a really nice wide overview of what is happening in the region completely.
Yeah, and well, what other things can people expect from the Filmmakers Festival this year?
So a few other really fun things is, of course, we have on Saturday the 42nd Fresh Film Festival. That is the 13 to 19-year-old portion of the Filmmakers Fest. We also have the Northwest Filmmakers Summit, which is a full-day event of vendors, panels, presentations. That's free for the public. That's happening down at the Portland Art Museum on Saturday, November 3rd. We also have a Northwest Exposure, which was an event. It's going to be a live table reading with professional actors, reading 7 short film scripts. It's sort of a competition thing. The winning script is going to get a whole bunch of really amazing prize packages from local production houses and companies. The idea being that from scratch to finish, this person will be able to create a film for free, basically. And then a really awesome opening night party in the sunken ballroom, uh-huh, at the Portland Art Museum's Scaryoki, a sing-along seance featuring large-scale props and all sorts of crazy fun things.
And what screening are you going to be part of, Paula?
So actually, the timing of my screening is perfect because it is in the afternoon following or as the same time as the Northwest Filmmakers Summit. And then the program that I'm part of was curated by Nora Colley, who's a local independent filmmaker and organizer, and it's called Change, Love, and Rage. And I haven't seen all the films in that grouping, but it looks like a terrific selection.
Are people going to have a chance to meet you and maybe even the subjects of your film?
Yes, I'm very excited that I will be there, as will George and Josh and their families. And I really hope people can come out. I've really encouraged them to invite their friends and families because, as I was saying to Ben, when I set out to make this film, I really made it for the community. And I really that was really my goal, and also hopefully to bring more people to the film center, you know, and not make it this, you know, I think some people feel like film festival is too exclusive or something, but it's a film festival for all.
That's right.
And you've got plans after this, right? You kind of started out in New York. You've done a lot of work for Filmmaker Magazine, and you're going to be heading off to New York with the film after this.
Actually, the film will be at Doc NYC, but I will not be able to be there, but don't feel too bad. I'll be in Napa at the Napa Valley Film Festival. So that's all good.
Well, the other filmmaker we have here to talk about his work, and it's a narrative feature, is Edward Pak Davie. And Edward, the title of your film is Lost Division.
Correct.
And as with Paula, you start out diving into a project and you come out of it years later, not realizing how long it would take. I mean, in Paula's case, this short documentary took a couple of years. In your case, it went in stages over 4, 5, 6 years, the making of this film about World War II.
Yeah, that's true. The first year we shot about half the film, and then we had to wait another year to recover and raise more money, and then just a long post-production phase editing. It's just takes me a long time. I'm slow.
Now, you are a veteran filmmaker, and you decided to go with analog technology for this story of 3 soldiers who go AWOL at the Belgian-German border during the end of World War II. And tell us a little bit about that and how you really got across that story with the technology, with the look of the film.
Well, one of the characters in the film is a combat photographer, a 16mm combat photographer, and so his character is shooting footage along the way. So, and we shot on an actual Bell and Howell, the same type they used in the war for combat footage, and so that has a timeless kind of authentic look to it. And then I wanted the rest of the film to kind of match that authenticity. And so something that looked a little more like the film stock of the time, a little more gritty, a little more crushed blacks. And, you know, I just did some tests and came up with a look that I liked that was seemed appropriate. And that involved some different exposures and processing techniques and such.
Well, without giving too much away, let's talk about the characters. This is kind of like, it's almost like a 3-person chamber piece, and one of the characters is a chaplain, and you had read some chaplain journals from World War II. You have veterans in your family. You have, your grandfather was a veteran of World War I and World War II, and you also had a neighbor, an interesting guy, who you met and got a chance to interact with, who himself went AWOL during World War II.
Yeah, his name was Clifford, and he would just show up in my backyard and start mowing the lawn. And this was maybe 15 years ago or so. And one day we got to talking, and he told me that he went AWOL, and he got caught. And as a punishment, he was sent to work on a minesweeping boat, like doing the graveyard shift on a minesweeping boat. So that's how that whole idea of the AWOL personnel came into my head.
And then the journals, the war journals, the chaplain journals, helped you flesh out the idea of this chaplain who wasn't just comforting the soldiers. The chaplain was often involved in burying the dead, and you see this quite explicitly in Lost Division.
Yeah, I was really struck by that. Time and time again, I read about chaplains being responsible for just temporary shallow graves. So just a lot of digging, as well as the usual chaplain stuff that you expect a chaplain to do. There's just a lot of grave digging.
So standing in for the Belgian-German border was the Hood River area, agricultural area east of Hood River. And you had obviously had some very patient actors and crew to see you through this really long process of making this film.
Yeah, and that's a great part of making films in Portland is the enthusiasm level can remain after a 5-6 year period. And so I'm eternally grateful for all the help that I got over the years on both my films.
Now, how can people find out about this film and see it at the Northwest Film Filmmakers Festival?
Well, they can listen to this fine radio show and, and that'll tell them. And then we have the Northwest Film Center has their schedules out and about. And
you have a website yourself.
I got a website and a Facebook event page. Yeah.
So that's Edward Pack Davey, D-A-V-E-E.
Correct.
And Paula, what's your website?
I have a website, paulabernstein.com, but there is also a website just for the film, which is souldoctorfilm.com.
And that's S-O-L-E doctor.
Correct. Film.com.
And Ben, we've got half a minute here. How do listeners find out more about this year's Portland Filmmakers Festival?
Sure. The easiest is, of course, going to their website, nwfilm.org. If you click on festivals, you can find the tab for the Northwest Filmmakers Festival. Click right there. It has all of the programs listed, other side little things, workshops, all the other fun things that are happening.
And again, it runs from Halloween through Guy Fawkes Day, October 31st through November 5th.
That it is. And passes are only $45 for everything.
For everything. Well, thank you so much, everybody, for coming in here. Our guests today are Ben Popp from the Northwest Film Center, along with filmmakers Paula Bernstein, Edward Pack Davey, and Quinn Costello. You've been listening to The Film Show on KABU. I'm S.W. Kotzer. Thanks also to the Oregon Media Production Association for their support and collaboration. And thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. The audio for this show, as well as our extended interviews, will be available later today on our archive page, kboo.fm/thefilmshow. And you can keep up with us on Twitter, at @KBOOFilmShow. Now stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your homegrown Portland radio station.